Welcome to the Lifetime at Work podcast, episode 18. My name is Greg Martin, and these days I dedicate my life to a business I own and run in Toronto called Farmer Prepared Meals. It's a passion sort of career. In my spare time, I record this podcast where I like to explore other people and their careers. I talk to people from all backgrounds to tell the real stories about their jobs and why they do them. For you, it's a chance to meet different people, and if I'm doing my job right, who knows? Their stories may inspire your life or your future career in some way. In this episode, I am talking about the nonprofit and charity world with the CEO of the United Way in the Waterloo region. So let's begin and get the intro music started. If you're a fan of this podcast, the two best ways to follow are to go to lifetimeatwork.com or to follow me on Instagram. I am gregmartin.work. And this episode, like all the others, are brought to you by Farmer Prepared Meals. It's the prepared meals company that I run, and you'll even see me on Instagram every once in a while. We make a lot of scratch food, things like soups and stews, lasagnas, shepherd's pies, all those sorts of things. And we deliver them weekly across Ontario, more and more cities. If you want to give us a try, go to farmr.ca and have a look and see what we're cooking up. Every week is a little bit different. And if you use the code IKNOWGREG, all one word, you'll get a discount. In this week's episode, I am talking with Joan Fisk. She started her career working in a family business. It was the textile industry in the 70s and 80s was really where she really got into it. She began running that business, and it was actually a really large one in the days before China was all dominant in the clothing industry. And so she learned a lot in doing that and running the company and growing it. Eventually in the 2000s, ended up retiring from that and doing a lot of more director type roles, working with companies and organizations in various capacities, but eventually found her way to the United Way in the nonprofit sector in the Waterloo, Ontario region. And the majority of the conversation as we have it is talking about that, about what she's doing now and the impact she can have, the need for charity in the nonprofits and what's going on and really her career and experience in trying to help and trying to make a difference and trying to raise money with organizations of all kinds. I mean, that's what the United Way is. They are typically go to workplaces and try to get donations from them and run a lot of campaigns and then sort of dish out that money to the various charities in the communities to talk about. But I wanted to have her on the podcast, and I think it's a really cool conversation because one, you know, her background is completely different, but two, I think now she's really found herself with a passion towards this and learning so much about what it's like to be in the nonprofit sector and the battles that you face. And just the need that is out there, which is something that I think in the traditional media, you just don't hear about that much, or you don't really get a good appreciation for. And so it's interesting to hear Joan talk about it and really, I think, enlighten the whole situation in many ways. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. You learn a little bit about sort of what's going on out there. Hear her perspective of, you know, working with a lot of different charities and fundraising efforts and that sort of thing for what is now her new career and what she's trying to do, positioning the United Way in Waterloo to be able to actually have an impact and improve the community and fill in, I think, as she says, fill in all the cracks that are occurring and the people that are getting missed. COVID's not helping. There's a lot kind of going on in the industry right now. So it's a cool conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Here's my interview with Joan Fisk.
Hi, Greg. I'm Joan Fisk. I currently am the CEO of the United Way Waterloo Region Communities. I've had a number of different roles in my long career, so I'm excited to talk to you about that today.
Yeah. I thought that might be the best place to start is maybe just describing what you do, you know, what the United Way is in Waterloo and what you do. And then I have a bunch of questions too. It'd be good to go through your past and how you got here.
That's quite the story. what I'm doing at United Way is I'm just over a three-year tenure at United Way where I have integrated two organizations, one being in Cambridge, North Dumfries, the other one being in Kitchener, Waterloo, and surrounding townships. And in that role, which mirrors the same geography as the region, in that role, we are primarily fundraisers that raise money for issues in the community that relate to poverty, basically, mental health, youth issues, children, seniors in isolation, all kinds of things. So basically what we do is we have a granting portal, which is actually called Arbitrium, which is an easy way to apply for grant. It's part of the modernization that I've been able to do over the last few years, where we take applications for various projects. Sometimes during the pandemic, we have waived any restrictions and said it's to keep the lights on, so it's general operating. We managed to supply $4.67 million in the year 2020 through the pandemic. And we did it with serving 122 different agency and partners in the community. So it's a very broad and important piece. United Way is an organization that picks up and fills in the cracks and crevices that show up in the community that you might not even see, that are related to issues of various ways. We've really concentrated on diversity and equality over the last couple of years. Particularly this year has been easier to do because it's been highlighted by the, you know, Black Lives Matter movement, the Me Too movement, things like that. So we react and collect data on where the hotspots are in the community, where we can make the biggest difference. Because I think one of the things that, you know, the pandemic has definitely changed stuff for everybody, for the world, for the globe. But in our case, it's enabled us to really understand where the most difficult parts of the community are and who needs the most support. And in some cases, we've seen a new cohort of folks that have come into needing supports, and whether it's food insecurity or whether it's particularly mental health. So when we do that, we go to our community and say, please help. Now, traditionally, a United Way campaign is done through workplace. That's where it started many, many years ago. In this area, United Way is 82 years old. And we have managed Mary's names. United Way was the last name, but it was Red Feather, United Appeal, all kinds of things along the way. And now we are morphed into doing this very important social service work in combination with the government. United Way across Canada delivers about $600 million in program funding. So it's a very significant part of the Canadian fabric.
Yeah. So like the way United Way works typically is what your focus is and what you're good at is, I guess, fundraising. And then from there decide, okay, the amounts that we fundraise, you know, where is it going and which organizations are we going to kind of support to help the community, but then leave it kind of to them to do the detailed work. Is that how it kind of works?
Well, currently, we don't deliver service at United Way,
right,
but we can sometimes guide folks. We also work on connecting people together so that the service becomes more efficient. So we can service a network of groups on a specific subject, particularly in counseling, so that we work with a collaborative. And we've been very instrumental in collecting folks together with the same purpose in different areas so that it becomes a bit more efficient.
Yeah.
And that particular funding can be concentrated on that particular problem. But United Way, it's interesting. Some United Ways in smaller communities do the work. They may be the food bank in smaller communities, but we're not. Right. We have very robust regional warehouse system of food in Waterloo. And so that's not our main focus. However, we do collect that, and so we do know, and we can be an intelligent source to bounce back ideas and innovation within that within the sector, basically.
Right.
We sit at tables to do this type of thing.
And your background, I mean, it's not, you've done a bunch of different stuff. And so I wanted to ask, I mean, talk briefly about kind of your experience and the things that you've done, and then, you know, probably what that will lead into is, why now? You know, working and running the United Way here?
Well, I kind of go backwards. I started 40 years ago. I'll start with how I got to United Way. I worked as the chair of the board for the Local Health Integration Network for Waterloo Wellington. So both counties, regions that moved together. And in that, I went into a situation where the LIN had been formed about 6 or so years before I got there. And I was asked by some municipal leaders, the chair of the region, et cetera, to go in there and see if I could help with, you know, with making it a more collaborative model, particularly with the service providers, health service providers. The budget was over $1 billion. It was a very complicated system, but it wasn't working because people weren't working together and they didn't trust their bank, basically. They didn't trust the lens. So we needed a lot of work. So I went in with another fellow who'd just taken over the role of the CEO, Bruce Lochner, who's now the CAO for the region. But at that point, he was the chair or the CEO. And together, after a little bit of, you know, hand-wringing, we figured out how to do this. So that's why I took on this job, because I was able to see through that lens where the community was really in need. Because there's never enough money, and there's never enough government health funding, and because primarily most of it goes to hospitals. And we started to see where community work really was lacking support. It really helped me. So when I was finishing that role, I had been approached by the chair of the board at the time at the United Way, asking me, what did I see the community really needed in leadership around the United Way, especially through this kind of tumultuous integration? So I gave them my ideas, and then lo and behold, they offered me the job.
Good answer.
I didn't really apply for the job, but it fell naturally into the concept of a really giving back role. And in that, I can do a give back role. And that's really what United Way is. But in parallel to United Way and to the Lynn, and previous to the Lynn, I spent 2 years at the Kitchener-Waterloo, the Greater Kitchener-Waterloo Chamber of Commerce as their CEO. I came in a role that had been left vacant just for a little bit, and they needed a different style of leadership. So I came in from a business world into a business agency, and I think I helped it.
Right. And so going backwards then more, I mean, your background was more in the for-profit world, right?
And the reason I ended up at the Chamber of Commerce was because I did a lot of governance work along the way in the communities. And so I was on the board of various things, task force, 13 different boards at that point. I was on an insurance board at the Gore Mutual, hospital board at one point, Symphony, task force on the apparel industry, all kinds of things that got me in place and in front of many people. So part of the transition into the chamber was the folks that I knew, which again morphed into the Lynn and now, of course, into the United Way. It's a community leadership role. My role at Tiger Brand wasn't a community leadership role. It was an industrial, very complex, very old company, started in 1881, that also needed modernizing. And I came into that career literally green. I was a family business. I was part of the family, never expected to take leadership. But I came in as the designer, marketing, creative side of a business. And the lucky thing for me was the business was ripe for change. And it was, it made men's underwear, basically. But then the t-shirt became part of that blue collar worker, navy, gray, black, green t-shirt. And there emerged in the 60s, the denim. Denim moved from workwear to streetwear. And the evolution of that denim, jean, t-shirt, sweatshirt world was happening throughout the 60s into the late 60s, early 70s. And it gave me the opportunity to take this knitting factory and take a look at the fabrics that it made with the dye house, turning it into all kinds of colors, and worked with a couple of different fashion designers and making knit patterns for people like Alfred Sun and Marilyn Brooks and Pat McDonough, names you probably wouldn't even know today. And then went on to do a pilot project with a fellow and created this little store called Cotton Ginny. And that was, again, taking that colored fabric and funny sweatpants and making tops and bottoms and bright pink, yellow, green, all kinds of neon shades into a very fashionable, slim-fitting sweatsuit. And that retail store exploded. But at the same time as that was working on it, I was able to change the way the company manufactured. And we were able to bring in other different types of knitting and other kinds of ways of doing it. But you needed to be able to do volume to manufacture in Canada. And our edge really was starting to be quality and speed, because China was just coming onto the forefront. And the biggest retailers could afford the long lead times and the giant orders, but the average small retailer couldn't. So there was a niche for a company like Tiger Brand, which started with yarn and finished with the garment. So I managed to take that and that leverage, and through the retail experience, created a line of clothing called Nonfiction. The idea behind that was everything was garment dyed, pre-washed, pre-shrunk. And that t-shirt, which you would buy, or jeans, by the way, you would buy, you wouldn't remember this, Greg, but jeans actually shrank. And they needed to be worn a number of times before they could even be not stiff. Well, the same thing was happening as jeans were starting to get washed, so were garments. And I moved into that very ill-fit capsule in the 80s of leisure wear. And although we can't even imagine going to work in proper trousers and suits and things, now that's what workwear was. And the landscape for clothing was changing. And I was able to change with it and move this factory with the change in times. At the time, I was pretty green, but I knew how to really sell. So I would take these products that I would create and make for little organizations, and also put a label on it for someone else. So that whole, sometimes you call it white labeling or private labeling, that whole business was also ripe to change. And that was the explosion of labeled branding, whether it was Lacoste Alligator or it was all kinds of things. But retailers became brands. So that's how the Gap became a brand. And I started producing for those kinds of brands, because the manufacturing, unless you have volume, you weren't going to be able to sustain your workforce,
right,
overhead in Canada. So we did that, and I made all the Eddie Bauer sweatshirts and all the names that you wouldn't know, even Abercrombie and Fitch before it was now what it turned into. And I think I produced for about 60 different private labels through a decade, and learned so much about where product needed to be. I started being able to back up Asian deliveries, because sometimes they get tangled up and late, and there would be this urgent need or something would sell, so they need me to fill in 60,000 garments instead of 600,000 garments. And things like a store now in Canada, Nordstrom's, were able to put together the Nonfiction line there. So it grew. And during that time, the company was transitioning into succession planning. My father, who was the owner and CEO president, made a decision in 1988 to name me president. I had two able-bodied brothers. One was the vice president of manufacturing in textiles, the other one in the garment side. But in slipped me into the role of the leadership. And that was a real tough time. It was a very tough time. And there was gender bias. There is still gender bias. Then it was even more so. The truck driver said to me, "I ain't working for no woman." And I said to him at the time, "Well, really, and why is that?" "Well, I never have and I never will." I said, "Well, then where are you going to work?" Because that was not on for me. But the company was buying yarn from the good old boys in the South, and they would take my brothers and fly them down to golf games and they were buyers, right? I was the seller. It was a different combination and dynamic. So I persevered, and we really pushed the company to start doing a combination of different things. I was at that point flying to Asia, doing some production, some woven production, because we weren't a woven house, and started to really firm up the collections and make them more fashion collections. Worked with traveling all over the globe, really, literally. And by 2005, it was evident that the organization would not be able to exist in its present state. The hollowing out of textiles and any kind of manufacturing where cheap labor was the death knell of any kind of company like this. In fact, shirts had already left, and single needle shirts like Forsyth and the Button Factory in Kitchener, and all these things had actually started to disappear. Shoe manufacturing out of Canada followed out very, very quickly. In fact, it happened over a 10-year period, which is almost more like a snap.
Yeah, that's fast. Yeah.
And we knew that something needed to be done, and we knew we couldn't sustain it doing that. And on top of that, we were unionized. We became unionized because we started to outsource. And as soon as some of the production was outsourced, it created an uneasy feeling within the inside of the organization. People that were on sewing machines were worried about their jobs, as would be normal. And the steel workers managed to sneak in and create a union inside the shop,
right,
which was the death of having sewing factories, because you couldn't pay such high wages in comparison to your competitor. It wasn't that they were such high wages. It was that they couldn't compete against pennies in the Asian marketplace. So we started to look for other avenues and how that organization would get sourced out even more so and hollowed out in a way that would be distribution, design, sales, creativity domestically, and the manufacturing would go offshore. But the lines of credit that you needed and the way it had to happen meant you needed a partner. So we searched out some partners in that, and one was found in New York, which had Chinese factories, and the company basically was sold to that concern. I chose at that point not to go. I had really looked at the situation and knew that I probably could have, but I chose not to, which created another whole part of the story, which we won't dive into today. But it was what led me to do some consulting in the apparel field. Traveled down to LA and New York and did some work for various folks, Disney, Ann Taylor, Eddie Bauer, a bunch of different people. And it taught me that I really did not want to get on an airplane again. And so that's why by 2008, I joined the Chamber of Commerce. 2010, I joined the LIN. And 2017, I joined the way. But along the way, I always had a board interest. I've always given back to the community. And I learned from that so many things. I can't begin to tell you.
And I guess there's a certain amount of just understanding what's going on, you know, and even though you're, say, now the CEO of the United Way, to really do what you want to do and do it well, you probably need to understand what's going on at the community level and with regular people as well, right?
Yeah, you do. And it's the future of charity is also very tricky, because there's been a groundswell of, well, how many cents to the dollar? And it actually hollowed out the ability for community charities to grow properly.
Yeah.
My job was to take two organizations, put them together and make them efficient, but also be able to continue to attract decent, sustainable talent and to modernize the back end, look at technology, see where it needed to happen. And at the same time, grow support within the community to support the United Way. I'm not there yet, Greg. It's not where I want it to be, but it's way better than it was. And I think that our relevancy is starting to be a little bit more apparent. But a big part of it, and where I think I come from, is that concept of brand. And without it, you're not the coolest kid in town, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have a brand that's not faded. It's not, oh, yeah, you know, United Way, but who is that? My grandfather's charity? Forget about it. It's old. It's really for me to attract the next level of donors in our community, because it's not about the amount. It's about the passion. Being able to think about your community in the way that you want to help it. Waterloo Region is sitting at around 630, maybe 635,000 people. We have affordable housing issues where the housing general entry-level housing prices skyrocketed. And we're looking at, although unprecedented interest rates being very low, we're seeing a generation coming in wondering how will they ever enter that part of the world. In the meantime, happily going along with their tech jobs or all kinds of things, making an okay kind of a living, unless you're not.
Yeah.
Unless you're not part of that educated cohort, unless you've lived in cyclical poverty, unless you have mental health issues, unless you worked in the tourism industry, which has been absolutely devastated by the pandemic, or maybe you worked in hospitality, or maybe you worked in just yet another place where those 200,000 jobs went missing in the last couple of months. So we've seen a new level of folks that need support. And it isn't the traditional, I just don't have enough, I know how to navigate the system. This is a group of people that have come in that never went and asked for a subsidy, support, or unemployment, or all kinds of stuff. So we help them with that. We help people figure out where to go to get the support that they need. I mean, we have lots of calls. We had a call from a woman pre-December having an absolute meltdown that her son, a 14-year-old boy, had drunk a liter of milk. And it was an irrational conversation because she wasn't really upset that her son drank the milk. She was upset she wasn't able to replace it. Where and how she was going to be able to feed her kids. And you can imagine, you're a boy. You were a growing boy at one point. You couldn't get enough food.
Yeah.
He was absolutely without the resources to know how to get it. There's where United Way comes in. We help connect people to where the supports are. And I was really proud that we could do that. And then it struck me, oh my goodness, how many more people are like that? How many more people are hidden underneath this veil of secrecy, of being an immigrant, not knowing how to manage, where to go, language barriers, schools out, all kinds of things. I think it's heightened awareness for me at United Way.
Yeah.
And making a contract with myself, a leadership contract, really, to lead this organization and put some strategic plans in place that will help us get to the future.
And because I think, too, so one of the questions I sort of have for you is just about getting involved in different ways and how people can contribute or honestly learn more about sort of the things that you are in that. And part of, I think, this podcast is a lot about transitioning, maybe starting in one career and then realizing, hey, this isn't exactly what I want, or I want to achieve other things and I want to get a sense for what else is out there, et cetera. And if you look at the nonprofit sector and say United Way historically, or if you have a job and you're working, in a workplace in a corporate setting, it's to do the fundraising, it's to donate, but what's kind of that next level? How do you get into, say, the nonprofit sector, and how do people who maybe have experience doing something else that isn't in this industry, but like you was in, is in fashion. It's not necessarily the most obvious, hey, you're going to get into nonprofit, but how does that kind of gateway happen to being involved in something that way? Because I think there actually may be more and more people who are just interested in that, but maybe don't know what it's all about, or how, they can get involved and start dedicating more of their life towards something like this.
Well, whether it's United Way or any kind of nonprofit, government is nonprofit. There's all kinds of things that come under that category. But really, this pandemic has done a lot of things. We will not be going back to what it was before. Last February is not going to be this February, and never will be again. So it's a fertile moment for change. It's a fertile moment to think about how you as a person fit. The mindfulness movement is really relevant about where is the joy in your life or not. And so I think about this work as being equal with for-profit work. I don't see it as being unequal. I see that not-for-profit organizations pay competitively now. It's not like you go and work for free, although as a volunteer you do, and I volunteered a lot along the way. And if you can, you get so much out of it. You get so much, you can't imagine. But we also know that remote work for the next little while is going to be the norm. And so we don't get to see that underbelly. Maybe we see somebody on the street corner begging for money and asking for some support. We see a person out of either drug addiction or any kind of other addiction. And you think, oh, goodness, and you close your door and you don't look and you just look straight ahead and you ignore that person. I see the underbelly of that now. I didn't before. I see the human trafficking piece that I never saw before that would just make you shiver, let me tell you. I think I really have understand the human impact of have and have not. It's hollowing out the middle of our society. And where we can act is by giving back a little bit. Sometimes it's just time. If you don't have a lot of money, time is a great thing to give. All of the volunteering pieces add to your capability to connect with the community you live in. And the stronger your community, the more vibrant the downtown core of the communities that you live in, the more satisfying it is where you live. And if you don't give, you don't see it. And you don't have to give a lot. And if you just give time, that's all. But that's your calendar. It is to help give you a purpose. And that's what social responsibility in companies is all about, is as well as making these wonderful, imaginative, giant-sized profits, whether it's a bank or insurance company, it's to give a little bit back to the communities that they live in, that the employees live in, that children live in. And United Way helps facilitate that kind of giving.
How many people would work at, like, actually paid employees that work with you at the Waterloo Region United Way?
18.
18. Okay. And slim. What sorts of things do they do?
Well, we have a core of a little bit of the technology piece, because credit cards are used and we have to be very, very secure in that part. We have the financial part, so that we have that admin part where the money comes in, it gets administered and properly managed. We are working on ePledge, so it's electronic printing, with somebody that works in marketing that helps with and develops, keeps the website up to speed and makes sure that marketing and messaging is up to speed. We have community investment. How do we get the grants out? We need to adjudicate them. We have volunteers that do that and work with us to look at the applications and the processes. So we have two people there, and we have fundraising. So we have a fellow that runs, directs the fundraising. We divide up the accounts we have, whether they're workplace. And then we have individual stewardship to try and help people see why they would manage. And we have sort of a front-end administrator, and we have me. So really, that's it. When I got there was 42 people, and now we have 18.
Oof. Okay.
So yeah. We really, really, really streamlined the organization, so it's very skinny. And I did that so that I could make sure we attracted the best talent, sustained the best talent, because you can't compete in the for-profit and not-for-profit world for bright people. You have to want to work in the not-for-profit sector, but you shouldn't be penalized to work in the not-for-profit sector.
Right. Yeah. And if you're doing a similar job that would be in the for-profit sector of similar skills, it can't be. Otherwise, you're just not going to be able to, like you're saying, attract the right talent and attract talent that stays. Otherwise, you know, they may not.
We've managed to all work, wherever you work, however you transition through your career, it's about leadership. It's about contact with yourself first in a leadership development. Because no matter where you are in an organization or with yourself or as an entrepreneur, you have to develop those skills that are embodied in leaders and know that it's lifelong learning. Recently, I listened to David Johnson speak on Leadership Waterloo Region, and he said that trust is the grease and glue of our society, the fabric of our society. And it struck me as the right thing. You need both, right? You need that staying power, and you need to have some agility and be able to move and pivot when you need to. But it's also to examine your capabilities and really know where you need some support and not. And then you organize your work and your life to fit that purpose. That's been the way I've managed. I've had, you know, in the meantime, there I was having children and working and doing all the things that you did. And that concept of being a super person has to take a little bit of a back step to, oh, you know, I forgot about yourself in that moment. So I have this concept of mapping my journey pretty well on a weekly basis to sort of see, partly that's a task-based journaling, where am I going to fit? And if it doesn't fit that week, and if it doesn't get done, it goes to the next week automatically. So I do a lot of that kind of mapping of my journey, because it keeps me focused and identifies where you will have a hiccup, and inevitably you will. There is no straight line.
Yeah.
And you know, there is no clear where you're going to be next year, Greg. You may not be exactly where you are here in this moment. But what you do know is you take the moment that you're living in today and put in that memory bank of yours, and that's a teacher all by itself. And so that's what I do. And, you know, I had to face some pretty big adversity when I first took on my role. I was 35 years old as the CEO of a pretty big company. We had 1,000 employees. It was a big undertaking. And I would go to bed at night frightened to death that I couldn't do it, but would never admit that. Got up in the morning, put on my suit, put on my pearls, got there, got going, made it happen. But underneath there was this trembling, oh my goodness me, can I do it? stood up against some crazy gender biases that you can't imagine that would have made the Me Too movement look scary. But you did it because it was the generation, and you turned a blind eye and you just kept on going. People don't need to do that now. And I'm very proud that people don't need to do that. Some guy puts his hand on your knee and says, "I know, honey, how you can get that order." I don't think so, buddy. But that happened then. And just because I was a female, I'd never have done that to a male.
Yeah.
But I learned from it, and I learned where it was appropriate to just walk away and where not to, and how to manage and transform an organization from being a staid old knitting factory. If you saw some old pictures, you would really, in sepia, like really old, old factory that evolved from some men that came over from Scotland in 1843 that made it and made the communities that they served, and many of those people that made our communities. And so now in this role, I'm giving back to those communities. But this is where you morph human and technology together. There's very few places you do that the way you do it at a charity, where you are asking people to support where they live, that love their hood, be there in person, in present. And if you can't be and you can give $10, that's amazing. It goes a long way.
Do you, and this may be a hard question, but the satisfaction, there's naturally, so say working in design when you were in the clothing industry, there's a certain, I think, I hope anyways, that satisfaction and sense of accomplishment that you got overcoming what you did to then, grow the company and run it and et cetera. Is that, how does that sort of compare to what you're doing now in terms of the satisfaction you get through being able to, fundraise and contribute? That's a little bit of what we're trying to do, I think, is trying to be successful and set a goal, accomplish things. And I'm wondering how those compare, because you've done them both.
This one is harder because it's very focused. When you know what you're doing, exactly what you're doing, and you make a few mistakes along the way, but you pretty well know what you're doing. You know how to train the people underneath you to do what you're doing. You know how the concept of digitizing that world, buying huge cutters that cut through patterns made on computers, and the whole concept of CAD, which was just coming out, computer-aided design, was just happening in the late 70s, early 80s, and transforming. You knew what you were doing. When you enter something like this, and you saw the charitable sector sinking, not growing, and you saw that the organizations that ran workplace campaigns no longer were doing it. Leadership was saying, "Oh, well, just choose any charity you want." People saying, "Well, why would I give to United Way? I just should give to the charity of my choice. I should just give to the Humane Society. I should just give to." So I had to figure out how to do that. It was a little harder. So I created a shopping cart of pockets of where you could, you could concentrating in mental health or youth or mm-hmm. So we tried this shopping cart, which if you went on our website, you'd see it now. So I think mapping out the destination for this took me back. It wasn't just asking people for money. It was demonstrating the need, the impact that you made, and why we were valid, why we were legitimate, why. And I'm not completely at the end of that why. But it's not an easy task, because we live in a world of instant gratification, and we also don't recognize we have 65,000 people living at or below the level of poverty in our own community. We kind of only see the rich. We see a few bits and pieces of homelessness, but we really don't see the underbelly that we're struggling will happen. We also know that if we don't get education embedded into that young junior generation, it won't rise them out of poverty. Education is almost the biggest lever there possibly is. You can give people a free bottle of milk, but you've got to get them education so that they can buy a bottle of milk someday. And that's part of what we do.
So there's certain people that, I guess, like you said, they only have $10 and they'll give $10 because they want to help and they don't have a lot. And there are some people that maybe can donate more than $10, but don't. What do you think it is about people or the experience, or what you think that maybe it's something they haven't seen or experienced that sort of makes you appreciate that and really want to give whatever you can versus ignoring it and not?
Well, I think we've lived we've evolved to a very insular life. I mean, all of us are looking at Zoom these days, and But, you know, our originally the BlackBerry, now iPhone, that basically, I call it stealing or robbing a whole bunch of your independence. And that the additional way that communication happens is very different. I don't believe journalism is, people don't really read journalistic investigative articles because it takes too long, right? Everything's instant. So you've got to figure out where you're going to embark on getting out of that shell. I think someday we'll see this generation come to and say, oh, what did happen for those last 10 years? What did I do the last 10 years of my life? But to prepare for giving, you have to be able to give to yourself and understand yourself and take that whole approach, and not just partying and not just having fun with your folks. If nothing else, the pandemic has halted us in our tracks and said, oh, by the way, you get to be with four people. Now, yes, there's some folks that don't just do the four people thing, but on the whole, our society, you know, we do what we're told, we're kind of. We look at this management of wearing a mask and social distancing, keeping it, we believe in it mostly, so we do that. But what if you're an hourly part-time worker and you work in a warehouse and you got those symptoms, but you can't stay home because otherwise you'd have no money? So we see pockets in the communities where we can advocate for that. I can see from the leadership of knowing the community where I can see we can make a difference. Communities will always have this underbelly. There will always be something that needs to be. There will be this influence, particularly the influence behind drugs. The fentanyl crisis, the opioid crisis, did not happen because of China. The opioid crisis happened to Big Pharma, you know, 4 or 5 decades ago. And so this isn't about poor people. This is about another whole layer in society where they got left behind and fell into the cracks. So I see I see a vital need for understanding the community. I've always given, so it wasn't really something I didn't, but because I could.
Yeah.
I knew I could. I didn't just think I could. Even when I could only give $100, I gave $100 because I wanted to help. And this generation does too. I believe it very much that this is a helping generation. It's very quizzical. They want to see the environment get cleaned up. They want to see all kinds of things happening. But we have to say to ourselves, but we want the whole thing. We can't just have clean oceans in a completely devastated community. So that's really what I see. I see that there's going to be a shift in the way people think. It's hard because there's going to be a bigger divide. So we will be relying on those folks that have the capacity and say, help those who don't have the same capacity as you. I went gone to Google, begging them to support United Way. Nope, don't support United Way. Well, what could I do to help you see that an influencer, you're an influencer, even if you don't want to support us financially, could you just give us a little bit of support and influence around people that really are live in world in the Google world? They said, well, we give corporately in the United States, and I could not grab their attention.
Yeah.
And so it's one of my challenges. How do I get that generation that sees, well, we don't see, you know, we see that 16 cents of every dollar goes into administration, so we think that's too inefficient. But it isn't.
Well, I definitely agree with you that, say, Instagram and Facebook and the media do not do a very good job of understanding what's going on in your community or the world in general. I mean, it's focused on, each of them, I guess, are focused on something very specific, and that over and over and over again. How is there a way, though? Is there a way that you think to be able to see what's going on? And, you know, and maybe to one of your points, like the pandemic is helpful in some ways because the world is different and it kind of unearths. It's like when you lift a rock in the garden and you see these worms that you didn't know were there, and then, then they're gone. Like, at least when things are kind of getting stirred up, you sort of see them. But how do you show people or understand? Because I do think also, to your point, that we don't really have a good conception of, say, how many people are working in a warehouse that are actually needed, or for, like you said, 1,000 employees at your that used to work with you. It's hard to quantify, hey, here's the number of people that actually are in this situation or need this sort of help, or, you know, and is there a way to show people or communicate that?
Well, you know what? I think that we can see it ourselves if we look for it.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's teachers see it. Teachers see it. And they see, and good teachers do support their kids in their community. They see kids come in without proper warm clothing. They see kids come in that haven't had lunch. A little organization was formed here in the region to help kids with weekend food because they realized, well, if they didn't get food at lunchtime or in the breakfast programs, they didn't have food on the weekend, what were they going to do? Because the parenting situation had fallen through the cracks. Understanding where you can make a difference. Sometimes just is awareness. I've been there. I know what it's like to be on welfare. I know what it's like to be a single parent. I know I've been there. So there's lots of that kind of thing that I think inspires people. But ultimately, if we give a little bit, even of our time, it doesn't matter if it's money or time. We get so much satisfaction from it. There's so much that it gives back to you to see an elderly person's face when you take that Meals on Wheels delivery to them, to know that you're the only contact that they probably had that week, to know that they're going to stretch that one gray bag of stuff for 3 days. That's when you know that there are parts of the community you didn't know before, that you didn't see. And so I'm proud to be able to do what I'm doing. I'm proud that I could help the community recognize. It's not an easy job. Will I be successful at it? I don't know. It isn't me that can do it. It's the leaders within our communities that can make it happen. The CEO of Manulife, all of those people can make a difference in the communities they serve. And they do. They do. They've been bent by making sure that they don't tell the employees who to give to. That's changed the way they used to be. We run a United Way campaign. That's what we do. No, now we run a third-party processor who makes money on this process called Benevity or Canada Help. They are for-profit organizations collecting charity money. We don't have that. Mm-hmm. So we've got lots of competition in doing it. And I don't see in the foreseeable future that it's going to be easy to do. But I'll keep at it. Greg, I'll keep digging at it because this is what I can do. I will also shape up a succession plan at United Way because that is another part of the role. I will try and develop the leaders of the future and have them be satisfied with what they're doing, excited by what they're doing, and inspired to grow leadership underneath them. Mentoring is the way to do it. All of us need mentoring. All of us need a mentor. Lots of us need a coach, no matter what stage you're at. It's lifelong. And I think that having had a long career, from a very interesting beginning where I landed with a little bit of luck just because I was where I was at the time. But it wasn't luck that I did what I did at Tiger Brand. It was hard work. It was thinking outside the box. It was taking something that existed and being entrepreneurial about it and taking those same talents and bringing that to all the things that I do.
One of my last questions here, what do you think is sort of the state of the nonprofit sector and whether it's, I don't know how you think in terms of Ontario or Canada, does a lot of the money come from, I mean, you said part of it's government, part of it is you know, workplaces and individuals. What is it like if you were to kind of characterize the industry of nonprofit? And because I imagine you touch it more than others because you get to see multiple organizations as being part of the United Way. Like, how are they doing?
It's shrunk. And so you would see maybe you would have had a heart and stroke in various provinces. There's only one that's a Canadian heart and stroke now. Charity is the product of skepticism of the way that it's been projected. Oh, that CEO must make it run around in an airplane. Absolutely not. But the way that media has spun out some things around charity. The We Charity scandal really was a scandal because it did unearth something that touched that was bad, but it hurt all charity to have one rotten apple in the barrel. And so we fight that all the time. And we are always saying to ourselves, if we educate our community and stay local, and we are local and we're not getting anywhere else but in our quadrant, our region, then we may be able to attract just a few more. And we have a very low percentage of donations for the size of our population compared to others. We're at the 12 out of 15 in a United Way for what our community supports as per capita. And my job is to get that number up, because we can. We have a fairly wealthy community. We should not be giving such a low percent. I think it's 2% in our community. And if I can inspire people to just give a little bit, it's less than a cup of coffee a day, think to yourself, you know what? You don't think of doing it. It's not even because you don't have the money. It's because you don't think to do it, because you're enveloped in your whole trauma and difficulties that yourself. But I like the fact that I'm not a Pollyanna. I'm not a poor, mean kind of person. That isn't me at all. I feel very, very blessed and lucky that I can take what I've learned over all of my career and give it back to this one. And to say, because I've been headhunted along the way from this one as well. I made a decision. I made a pact. Here I am. And the first 2 years of doing this job were pretty tough. I almost wanted to say, what did I do that for? But all you need to do is see one kid, just one, melt your heart. See how Pathways to Education is helping somebody and so thrilled that you helped them. See how independent living is helping get some kid a device to make them more independent that it only had no fingers. It's the things that you didn't know you could do from either the March of Dimes, all kinds of things that you give to. You're not the only one getting to them, but you're giving to them. And they can't do what they do. They can't do that extra bit. At the Langs Community Center in Cambridge, for instance, they give out, they do food programs, they do all kinds of things, exercise programs, you name it. But they have kids that come there from ages of 13 to 16 that have nowhere else to go. And if they didn't have a place to go, they get to gangs on the street. So this is what community can do to make a healthier community, is help support it, be there for it, and just think outside yourself sometimes.
And on that last question would be, for people to learn more or get involved, I mean, you mentioned it in a few different ways throughout the conversation, yeah. But what would be the lasting advice or idea you would give people in terms of just, I guess, learning more and trying to understand what's going on out there better?
For sure, you can go look at the website, www.iamtheone. One of our lines is, I am the one. Are you the one? Are you the one that needs help? Or are you the one to give? So sometimes you'll see some of my logos say, are you the one? ? But the United Way Waterloo Region Communities has a website. It's very explanatory. It tells you lots of stuff. We are working on improving it because part of nonprofits is you don't have a fancy web designer. We are working at it in little bundles. We are looking at trying to help the community see what we managed to put an ad together on radio. Rogers helped support us through the Christmas holiday giving. And lo and behold, the community donated $230,000, some of it matched by generous donating folks, and came to us and said, oh, I didn't realize, you know, so here's $50, here's $200. And we were able to inspire people to donate. And the most exciting thing about United Way is we turn it around and everything that comes in within 12 months is out. So it doesn't linger. We raised the money at the COVID in March last year, very quickly raised almost $500,000 for a COVID emergency fund. So there's lots of ways of doing it. It's not just doing it in a silo. To know that you're part of a community that has social supports, because if we don't see that in 3 years, we're going to be in austerity at government support because of the trillions of dollars that are going to be hanging over the generations to come. That's one of the reasons that I'm driven so much to improve the efficacy of the United Way so that we can be there to help when there isn't going to be as much to help the fallout.
Yeah. Well, Joan, thanks for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you for what you're doing too, because you're helping folks learn a little bit about different lives, and everybody's story is different. Mine is pretty crazy different. But, you know, if we had another 5 minutes, I'd tell you another, you know, you can unveil the curtains and find out all kinds of things.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think you end up in your sort of silo, knowing the people you know, and not really, you just don't think about it, or you don't know who you should be meeting or how to do it or whatever. And if I can sort of help with that, then why not? I think at the very least, you learn something, and maybe you like something, maybe you don't, but yeah. You know, learning it is all the better, I think. So, yeah.
Thanks. I had a great, my grandmother was influential in my life on my mother's side, and she once told me, don't let your wishbone get in the way of your backbone. So you need that resilience.
Yeah.
So on that note, Greg, thank you so much for your time and your interest, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation and maybe think about donating a little bit of money to a cause that you may have out there, whatever it might be. Doesn't have to be the United Way, but whatever it is. I hope that this shed a little bit of light on some of the things that are going on out there. If you have an idea for a guest that would be great for the show, go to lifetimeatwork.com and there you'll be able to shoot me an email or a request and let me know, and I'll definitely get back in touch soon. And until next time, don't worry, be happy.